You are listening to the Loikamania Pop Culture Podcast. Is brought to you by CheapGraphicNovels.com, where you can purchase your favorite trade paperbacks and hardcovers for up to 45% off cover price.
How's it going, everyone? Pat Loika here. You're listening to Loikamania, episode 57. And today I have a very special guest. He is he's someone who's kind of living the so-called fantasy life I've always had, and that's, you know, to work in comics and to work in, get involved in some capacity with pro wrestling, because I'm a big fan of that stuff. His name is Aubrey Sitterson, and he was an editor at Marvel. During his tenure there, he edited books like Blade by Mark Guggenheim and Howard Chaykin, Robert Kirkman's Marvel Team-Up and Irredeemable Ant-Man books, and so many more. And, of course, after that, he left to do, he did some freelance editing. He edited for Robert Kirkman himself, actually. He edited The Walking Dead and Invincible for a bit. And he eventually moved on to work with WWE.com and worked on their website and wrote stories there. He did some journalistic stuff that you'll hear about here in the show. Very fun stuff here. It's about an hour and a half of talk about both industries, how it's like to work for, either side. And we also talk about the comics and the wrestling business as it currently stands right now, just as, from our fan point of view. We talk about, stuff like digital comics, the marketplace right now, just a lot of things here and there. And it's a pretty good discussion, very spirited, I thought. And it should be fun to hear. I mean, he comes from a very interesting place as far as, both businesses are concerned. So I think you guys may get a kick out of it, rather. You could check out some of the stuff that he has worked on. Like the Irredeemable Ant-Man or those Blade books by going to our friends at CheapGraphicNovels.com, where you can purchase those books at a really, really good discount. Again, that's CheapGraphicNovels.com. Of course, you can find me at all my usual spots on the internet. Go to about.me/PatLoika and get all my social networking links. And, of course, my Twitter account is twitter.com/PatLoika. And also, I'd appreciate it if you'd stop by iTunes and give the show a nice review and... it helps us. It helps our visibility. It gets more people to check us out. So I appreciate that, that if you did that little favor for me. So until next week, you guys take it easy. And actually, since I'm in a good mood, I'll tell you who's coming up next week. Next week, we have Phil Noto, the brilliant illustrator. Phil Noto is going to be on the show. And we have a very, very fun discussion about his career. And I think you guys will dig it. So in the meantime, enjoy my chat with Aubrey. And we'll see you next week. You guys, take it easy. And we're back. This time I'm with our guest. He is he was an editor over for Marvel for a while, and he has worked for the WWE as part of their website. I have Mr. Aubrey Sitterson. Welcome to the show, Aubrey.
Hey, man. How you doing?
Good, man. I've been looking forward to this chat for a while because we seem to share the same interests. And I think this would be a fun little thing to talk about.
Comics and wrestling.
Yeah, I know. They seem to go hand in hand, especially lately. There are a lot of people coming out of the woodwork, especially as far as comic creators who are like big wrestling fans and wrestlers who are big into comics. It's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I see, earlier today I was watching CM Punk have a conversation with Ed Brubaker, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, that was great. And then the other night he kind of called out Brian Michael Bendis also about I think Brian Bendis was in line for some movie and Punk kind of called him out for it. It's pretty funny when you see your geek worlds colliding, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Before we kind of get into all that stuff, you were, as I mentioned, you were with Marvel for a while, and you were an editor there. Among the books you edited was The Irredeemable Ant-Man by Robert Kirkman, Phil Hester, and Andy Parks, which was one of my favorite books. I have to first thank you
awesome.
For helping put that together.
Oh, no, a pleasure. It was a blast to work on it. That was actually my second time working with Robert. I had edited Marvel Team-Up that Robert wrote and actually Phil and Andy did covers for towards the end of the run. I did Robert on that, and then sort of moved over to Ant-Man for the launch. And things went well enough, I guess, that after leaving Marvel, I started editing Robert's image books. So Walking Dead, Invincible, and at the time, Astounding Wolfman 2.
Oh, cool. For some reason, I missed that. I'm so used to – I never really think of the editors as being a big part as far as the creator-owned books like that. Because I'm used to thinking of editors in more on the big corporate comics side of things for some reason. But, someone has to put those books together too, even on the creator-owned level. Let's talk about your time at Marvel. My first question for you with regards to that is how did you get started there? I mean, what was your way in? Because there aren't that many people that you hear about seeking out the editorial type of job, so I was always curious about that.
Yeah, like a lot of folks who come in as editors at Marvel, I started as an intern. I was going to school at NYU, and I got an internship by sort of sheer force of will. At the time, the internship program wasn't as sort of rigorous and well-defined as it is now. And I was trolling the Marvel website, which also wasn't as well put together and bright and shiny as it is now, and found old information about the Marvel internship program and ended up just sort of, because I sent emails to places and they either bounced back or I didn't hear anything back. And so I just started calling Marvel and just sort of worked my way through their labyrinthine phone system until I got to Mary Sprouts, who's actually the VP of Human Resources, and sort of called and harangued her on, I think, almost a weekly basis. And so eventually she put me in touch with Tom Brevoort's office. At the time, it was Nicole Wiley, who now is Nicole Boos. I got in touch with her, and I was brought in for an interview with her and Andy Schmidt and Mr. Brevoort, and things went well, and I started interning that same year.
And then basically from interning, you made your way up to editor. Now, as far as interning goes, I'm assuming it's a lot of menial labor, like copy stapling, that sort of thing. Was there anything different about working, for Marvel and doing that stuff?
For me, it was a blast because I got to sort of look behind the curtain. And I think that even in the time that I was at Marvel, because I started interning, I think in 2000, late 2004, early 2005, right? And I left, 2004, mid 2004 is when I started interning there. And by the time I left Marvel, after working there full time in 2008, there had been sort of a lot of dramatic changes in the way most people did their artwork. And when I started working there, it was almost, we got packages in almost daily of penciled artwork that we'd then repackage and ship out to the inker. And more folks are doing stuff digitally. So a big part of my day when I started interning at Marvel was making photocopies, like reference photocopies of any kind of pencils and inks that we got in and things like that. But by the time I left, there's sort of a lot less of that because people were doing things digitally and firing them back and forth like that. I'm sorry, could that answer your question?
Yeah, that's a good. That's interesting because, there's been a lot more. Like, I've interviewed a few artists here on the show, and it seems to be more commonplace now to do digital artwork and sending scans in rather than mailing out and FedExing artwork. I guess it also prevents stuff from getting lost in the shuffle.
Absolutely, yeah, and it saves time too. It saves time and it saves money. The time's sort of the more important part, I guess, because if you're on deadline and you're going to lose an extra 2 days just shipping these packages back and forth. And so, a lot of people too even do, they'll pencil it. Like, they're doing everything analog still, right? But they'll pencil it and then they'll do a high-res scan, send to an inker who has a blue line printer, and they can print out their own copies of it. Interning was fun. And, a lot of sort of sitting around and observing, which is sort of the best part, which is sort of seeing how the offices worked and things like that. And reference gathering was a big part of it, which was really fun too, because I was a comic book fan, but I didn't have, it's hard for anybody to have a fully expansive knowledge of, the Marvel Universe or something like that. And so just having at my disposal every comic I could possibly imagine, and having to dig through them a lot of times to find reference, I learned a lot about the characters and the company and the storylines and things like that.
Awesome. And I'm assuming you have full access to their library while you're doing that work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a blast, too. I mean, you know, and they have their own separate library room with bound versions of all the not everything. Every once in a while, you won't be able to put your hands on something just because, you know, the company's been bankrupt a couple times and moved a bunch, so things get lost. But for the most part, anything you would probably want to find, you can get your hands on sort of bound versions of it back there.
That's pretty cool, man. And then they probably have a lot of stuff there that's collected that's never been actually collected for release, which is a shame.
Sure. And some of it for pretty good reasons. Because it's just bad.
that's also true.
You know, they're full shelves full of just bad comics that nobody really wants to collect. But that stuff's fun, too, just to be able to look through it all. And you get to look at the original versions, too, which is great to see all the old ads and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it was fun, man. It was a really exciting thing for me to get to do while still in college.
I imagine that job would be a lot of fun for the most part. Now, about the job itself, though, I mean, as editor, you know, you obviously you put together creative teams and you make sure everyone's in line. Aside from that, though, what else does an editor actually do aside from, you know, putting the book together? Or is there that much work in the editorial gig that you really have no time to do anything else? Or there's really no time for any special projects or anything like that?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. The biggest and the most important job that an editor ever does, in my opinion, is choosing a talent and assigning a talent. And I mean, and we're talking about like Marvel and DC style editors. You know, like you mentioned before that, you know, an editor on an Image creator own book, it's a very different gig than editing a Marvel book. And neither is better or worse. It's just different because different things are required of you. But in Marvel and DC, I imagine, I didn't work at DC, but from my understanding, you know, the biggest and most important thing that you ever do as an editor is choose your talent. Because and this is sort of a Brevoort thing that he imparted to myself and other people in his group, which is just, as an editor, your job is to pick the talent who's going to do the job the best and then help them do their best version of that book, right? Which isn't to say that you pick guys and then you sort of browbeat them into doing the book that you want to see, but you pick the guys who you have confidence in they're going to do the job right and then help them do the job right. So, the sort of catch or the line that I use on people a lot of times when they ask you, what exactly does a comic book editor do? I say that it's two parts. You know, one is traffic cop, because you've got, on all those books, you've got a writer, a penciler, inker, colorist, letterer, sometimes multiples of those, right? Sometimes you have a couple inkers or a couple colors. But usually you have about five different freelancers, and all those people are out of house, and they're all over the country. And so you've got to play traffic cop and make sure things come in when they're supposed to, and then they get to the next stage of production. But along the way, you also have to do quality control. And so being an editor at Marvel or DC, it's a really fascinating and really difficult job, because you have to know how to talk intelligently and how to assess and critique so many different art forms, right? You have to be able to do story notes and look at dialogue and things like that, make sure characters are depicted properly and that the plots make sense and they're going the right place. But you also have to be able to critique storytelling in the pencils, making sure things pop and are clear in the inks. Colors, you should have at least sort of a rudimentary appreciation and understanding of color theory. And you need to be able to look at lettering and have sort of a good design sense to be able to make sure the lettering and the covers and everything read properly. So it's a lot, you know. And you're doing that on sort of every book that you're working on too. And that's in addition to, you know, if you're interested in, like when I was there, one of the things that I was really interested in was starting up new projects, and which is tough in any kind of economic situation, but it's particularly tough now, obviously. But that was something I was really interested in, and something I really want to do is start new projects and come up with ideas and find the guys to work on them and stuff like that. And so you have to do that around the edges as well. So it's a full plate.
Yeah, what you just mentioned about, you know, having, you know, knowledge of, you know, stuff like color theory, design, and page layout and all that stuff, that is really fascinating. Because, you know, you think of editors, you think, a lot of people seem to think that editors just, you know, they just go over copy, or, you know, they think of editors in, like, you know, in something like print media, like newspapers, that sort of thing, and, you know, just reading articles or editing, going over that stuff, not really thinking about, you know, the visual element of things, especially comics being a visual medium. I appreciate the fact that you mentioned that, though, that you do all that stuff as well, because I think not many people realize that, and they don't realize all the actual work that you guys really do. And then you mentioned the... go on.
Oh, it's important. And, you know, like, I don't know. I don't think everybody does that, but I think everybody should. And everybody should strive to. You know, when I started at Marvel as an intern, I didn't have an artistic background at all. And so it was a struggle for me to learn this stuff. But, you know, I thought it was important. And not everybody does, but they should. And the best editors do. You know, when you're talking about, because otherwise, you know, if you're not able to assess those things, you're not able to tell who's good and who's not, right?
Yes.
You know, like if you want to build a great team for a book, you have to be able to know how to pick the best of everything, right? And to do that requires a certain base level of knowledge. And so I thought that was really important. One time I was talking to a former comic book editor, and we were, I don't remember what we were discussing, but we got to the point where, you know, we sort of stopped talking about a particular story and I started talking about the art, right? And like how I didn't really think the art served the story, and it was a good artist, but it was just sort of a bad choice and things like that. And his response was, oh, well, you know, I always dealt more with the story side of things, which I thought was the craziest thing that a comic book editor could possibly say, because that's not only is that only dealing with half, but I'd say, honestly, the less important half, right? The visual is the most important half. And, you know, you need the story and you need the writing to get to that point, but ultimately you're making a visual product, and to separate those two and to say, yeah, that's not really my concern is, I don't know, you shouldn't be working in comics. You should be doing something else. I think that stuff is super important. And a lot of times I wish that I had more of an artistic background, because I think I'd be better. I would have been better at my job. I know I would have been, because I wouldn't have had to learn so much on the job.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you put together some good looking books. Like, you know, I mentioned Ant-Man, you mentioned Marvel Team Up. I thought you did a pretty good job. Now, you know, all things considered, now of course you end up leaving Marvel later on, and you mentioned that you edit for Robert Kirkman's books. Now is there a difference as far as, you know, the way you work when you work for them or for Robert's books?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm not editing Robert anymore. Uh-huh. I edited Robert from 2008 to 2010. I mean, early 2010. Mm-hmm. He needed somebody full time, just because he was starting to Skype Online, and he needed somebody full time, and preferably on the West Coast.
Okay.
So that wasn't really for me. But yeah, it's very different. And what Robert needed when he brought me in, you know, Robert had been running those books on his own for years at that point. And he had been acting as the editor. Like most of the guys who do Image books, the guys who write it and draw it and whoever's the creator, you know, the head creator on it, they edit it and they do everything themselves. They traffic the files. They keep everybody on deadline. They give notes if necessary. So when he brought me in, he didn't really need somebody for that. And he didn't really want them. And which is understandable, because, you know, like I've been doing Invincible and Walking Dead for years, he didn't really need somebody else to come in and tell him that, oh, you're not really writing Mark properly or whatever, you know. Like, and I wouldn't have wanted to do that, honestly, because it wouldn't have ended well. What he really needed was the traffic cop side of things. He needed a timekeeper, and he needed somebody to keep, not even the artists, because the guys he's working with, Ryan Otley and Charlie Adler, those guys are mind-blowingly fast. They can do... they can not only do a monthly book, they can do a monthly book plus. You know, those guys are really, really talented and really fast, which is just an incredible combination. But what Robert needed is, you know, working across three of his own books, because he was doing Wolfman at the time too, as well as, you know, he's doing stuff for Top Cow and various other bits and pieces. He just needs somebody to stay on him about, you know, why haven't you written 8 pages today? You know, the script needs to be done by the end of the week. Have you turned in that issue yet? And stay on top of him about that stuff. And so it was really, a traffic cop aspect of things for him. And sort of as a point of comparison, after I worked with Robert, I actually started working with Mark Guggenheim, doing something very similar for his Collider line of books at Image, uh-huh. which included Halcyon and The Mission. And I'd worked with Rob or Mark at Marvel as well. I edited Blade that he and Howard Chaykin did.
Oh man, I love that book, by the way. Yeah, they had some amazing covers by Marko Dragicevic too. It had some of the best covers going during its run, and I was really sad when it ended. And
me too, man. That was one of my favorite things. That was one of the things I was most proud of when I was at Marvel too. When I left Marvel, that was sort of one of my proudest achievements. Because not only did I think it stood together as a whole, but I thought each individual, you know, it was Marko like a TV season, you know, so there was a big overarching plot of each issue could stand alone. Mm-hmm. But even on top of that, what I was most proud of was that it was the same creative team for all 12 issues, which is unheard of. It's crazy.
And you got Gene Colan for the final issue too, which was awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, that was such a great book. Oh, man. I love that book. I didn't realize that. For some reason, I completely forgot that you worked on that book. But yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah, I did Blade. And I did Ghost Rider. I did the Jason Aaron Ghost Rider. And a bunch of the not all, but a good portion of the Matt Fraction and Rick Remender Punisher War Journal.
Oh man.
And I started Strange Tales. It came out after I left, but I started that. And a couple of the miniseries and stuff too, like the Howard the Duck, like the Ty Templeton, Juan Bobillo, Howard the Duck, and stuff like that. X-Factor also. I'm sorry, I get distracted easily. With Guggenheim, it was sort of a midway point because he wanted somebody to keep schedule and traffic the files and stuff like that. But he also wanted somebody to be a little bit more hands on than I'd been with Kirkman. And so, you know, I helped him find artists for the books. I gave notes on some scripts, and I would look at layouts and designs and stuff, and give notes back and things like that. And so it was a little bit closer to sort of the Marvel side of things. Right now, the book I'm editing is Kick-Ass for Marvel, and or for Icon rather. But you know, mostly for Mark Millar and John Romita Jr. But you know, if you're working with Mark Millar and John Romita Jr., those guys don't really need notes from me, right? And same thing with Colin Palmer and Dean White. Those guys are and Chris Theopolis, of course, on 11. They're the best in the industry. You know, it's I think it's the greatest creative team on any comic book in the industry right now, and they don't need notes from me. So with that, it's mostly trafficking, scheduling, making sure things get to where they need to go, proofreading the letters, and then going into Marvel and making sure the book gets put together properly. So, you know, to answer your question, like it varies project to project. And even at Marvel, it varies project to project, because if you're working on, if you're working on, like I assisted John Barber on Old Man Logan, right? Mm-hmm. And that was Mark Millar and Steve McNiven. Those guys are at the top of their game. There's very little you need to do with those guys aside from just make. And it was like a Elseworlds type story too. So you didn't really need to worry about continuity there either, right? Yeah,
they could just go nuts and do whatever they wanted.
Exactly. But then again, on the other side of the session, if you're working on part of a crossover, right? If you're working on a Civil War tie-in or something like that, it's of the utmost importance that every single panel and beat be monitored to make sure it doesn't spoil or trample over or contradict something else going on in one of those crossover books. So not only does it vary between, you know, companies that you're working for, but even within a company, it varies how much input and how much involvement you have with these books.
All right, that's fantastic. Man, I apologize that I did not know about some of that stuff because there's just so much stuff out there right now. But yeah, Kick-Ass, you know, it's one of those books I trade weight on. Because I don't know, it just reads better that way, and unfortunately it takes a while to come out. But it really does have a fantastic creative team, though. I mean, between Romita,
that's something we're fixing, though. The wait between issues, we're on a clockwork, like every 6 week schedule now. And we just had a what is today? Today is
the 15th. Yes.
Yeah, I think. Not this coming Wednesday, but the following Wednesday, there's going to be another issue of Kick-Ass out, and that's only a month after issue 3 came out. And then
Excellent.
6 weeks after that, we're going to have issue 5 out. So we're getting on schedule, man, and we're gonna fix that. Because I feel you. I only started editing Kick-Ass with this volume, and I remember feeling the same way about when the first volume was coming out, that it was a tough book to follow, as much as I loved it, just because it came out so irregularly. I didn't even know when. It's not even that it came out. There's a long way between issues. It was just that it was irregular and it's never new. But we're fixing it. We are every 6 weeks now, so be on the lookout.
No, that's good to hear, man. And you know, aside from editing, of course, you got into writing your own stuff, and you worked for WWE.com for a while, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. I was a writer, editor, producer at WWE.com between 2008 to 2010.
Okay, and by producer, I mean, do you produce like actual like video skits, that sort of thing, or do you what does that entail as far as the website's concerned?
You know, the title was multimedia producer, and what I actually got hired to do was to come in and write, because at the time they were doing, and they're sort of getting back to that now, it looks like, but at the time they'd been doing a lot of sort of like fake journalism. Andrew C. leaving his house and doing this, whatever. And I was really excited about that. I'm a big wrestling fan, like yourself. Mm-hmm. And I was really excited to do that. But while I was there, they sort of changed the focus, and it sort of evolved into more of, there's still some writing, but it was mostly, match recaps and match previews and things like that. And for the producer role, we would work with, the graphics team or the video guys to sort of develop these larger features and things for the site. But I wasn't actually editing video myself. It was more like a producer of a film, I guess, just sort of, bring all the different components together and organizing it and then providing a copy as well.
Man, okay. That sounds like a fun job, though. I like the fake journalism thing that you mentioned. Like, it's kind of like the old WWF magazines from way back, where they would come up with all these stories as to where these supposed people came from, or they would come up with all these things about the backgrounds of the characters. And I always thought it was hilarious.
I know that's what I wanted to be doing, and that's what I thought I was going to be doing when I came in. But they sort of, as often happens in business, especially with online stuff, they get new numbers in, or a new boss comes in, and everything changes, and things sort of spin in a different direction. And that's sort of what ended up happening, unfortunately. But it looks like they're getting back to that. I've been noticing on Dirt Sheets and on Twitter and stuff like that, they've been doing more and more articles about, sort of advancing storylines, which is cool.
Yeah, the actual show itself, they do acknowledge that the Dirt Sheets and all that stuff exist these days. I thought it was funny. They're really trying to kind of, bend reality, so to speak, and they're trying to get more people, I guess more of the, because they know a lot of the lapsed fans or the fans who haven't been watching are the guys that still read the Dirt Sheets and all that stuff, and they like having people look into that stuff. Did you have any particularly interesting encounters while you were working there with any of the talent or anything in general?
Unfortunately, WWE, they're based in Stanford, and they have actually three different buildings, right? They had the Titan Tower, which is the one that you can see from 95 with the big WWE flag on it and everything. Then they've got the TV studio, which is massive, and then next door to that, there was sort of a smaller building. I'm not sure if they owned it or if they rented space in it, but that's where .com was. And so we were sort of the redheaded stepchild off the side. So, yeah, I didn't get to meet as many folks as I would have liked. But every once in a while, because WWE has their own gym in Titan Tower, and so I go over after work to use the gym. And every once in a while, even though I was told he had his own personal gym also in the building, evidently, I guess the big gym had more equipment or different equipment. Vince would come in and try and get to sort of, you know, nervously watch Vince work out while I was working out, which I was really self-conscious because that guy's massive. But, you know, most of the wrestlers, they live somewhere else. You know, a lot, most of them live down in Tampa, it seems like, or Florida, somewhere, just because there's no state income tax and it's warm, you know, and because they're traveling anyway, so they can live anywhere. So not too many guys came by the offices, but I did see Triple H around a lot, right, because he and Stephanie live local, obviously. One time I was going up to the gym, right, and so I came into the ground floor, and I was waiting for the end of the day, so, you know, there weren't a lot of people around. And the doors opened up, and, you know, I was just exhausted from a day and not looking forward to going to the gym. The doors opened up, and it was Stephanie and Triple H, right? And I just got, like, the biggest stupid grin on my face because, I only been working there, like, a month, and, you know, it's Stephanie and Triple H. It's the McMahon-Helmsley faction in the elevator. And Stephanie looked at me like I was the village idiot. Like, she was just absolutely disgusting with me and sort of kept moving. And Triple H just sort of gave me sort of, like, I don't know. It seemed like sort of like a sad, knowing smile and a nod, as if to say, "Yeah, I get it. I know. Please don't say anything." And I didn't, of course. You know, I wanted to. I've only been working there a short period of time, but I maintained composure.
You mentioned Vince. I was about to ask if you've had any encounters with Vince himself personally, or if you actually interact with him, because I hear a lot of funny stories about that guy.
No, unfortunately, I didn't. I mean, I sort of interacted with Shane a fair amount, oddly enough. Not in, like, business settings or anything, but just, like, one time I was over at the Tower. They had, like, a screening, and they allowed people from different departments, and I got selected to go watch Behind Enemy Lines, Columbia, with Mr. Kennedy in it. And it was really funny, too, because it wasn't – that wasn't a good movie, but we actually saw it before they even put in, like, all of, like, the post-production stuff, and so there wasn't any music, so there are all these, like, silent scenes of just helicopters flying around, and there were also, you know, I didn't realize this, but evidently, like, when they do, in films, when they do, like, RPG attacks and, like, missiles and things like that, I mean, if I thought about it, I guess I would have realized, but, you know, they're not actually shooting RPGs, and they add that shit in post. And so none of that stuff was there. So you just have, like, Ken Kennedy and his pals, like, standing in front of a tree and say, "Oh, no!" And they'd jump out of the way, and then the tree would explode, right? Because the missile or the RPG or whatever isn't in there. But anyways, I was there for that, and they had, like, there was, like, cater, and they had, like, sandwiches. And Shane came in and got a sandwich and introduced himself to everybody, right, which I thought was really nice. But then whenever I saw that guy, for the rest of the time I was there, whenever I saw that guy in the in Titan Tower, like when I was there at the end of the day or at the gym or whatever, that guy would say hello. That guy would stop and say hello, and you remember my name, which I was really shocked and sort of impressed by. I guess it's not a super common name, but still, I don't know. I thought that was really great. So he was a really nice fellow.
I actually heard a lot of good things about, you know, about Shane himself. I think he was the most normal one in that family, from what I'm hearing.
That's what people say. Yeah, people say he's sort of the most genuine and amiable.
That dude, though, I mean, whenever the occasional time that he actually steps in the ring and he goes in, that dude can bump like crazy, and it amazes me that he does that, and that they would let him do it.
It's really impressive, right? Like,
yeah.
That guy has no reason to be doing leaps of faith off of the Titantron, right? Like,
yeah. Remember that match he had with Steve Blackman, and that was one of the most amazing falls I've seen on ever.
He did another nasty one on Kane too, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he did, and then of course there's that King of the Ring with Kurt Angle, and he wouldn't go through that glass thing, and they had to do it like three times, and that was insane. I always respected that dude. Then when I heard that he's actually a pretty decent guy, like, yeah, even more respect for that guy. And it looks like it's unfortunate that he kind of had enough of that company that he ended up leaving the family business to go do his own thing.
I guess, yeah. I don't even know what that guy's doing. Last I heard him on the Dirt Sheets, they were talking about him doing, like, investing in, like, pay-per-view entertainment in China or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. With regards to your experience there, you know, working for the WWE, though, what was the best part of that job? I mean, with Marvel, you mentioned that the best part was being able to just kind of see the books come together from behind the scenes. And with the WWE.com side of things, what was it that you really enjoyed?
Step back for a minute. Like the Marvel, like the best part of Marvel to me really was getting to be part of it. Honestly, yeah. Like, you know, as an intern, it was fascinating to watch things come together, but to actually be part of it and make these decisions and sort of contribute to this mythology that so many people have such a huge connection to, that was the big thing for me at Marvel. And it did make me sort of different because I wasn't on the creative team. I wasn't helping write the scripts or doing anything like that. So it was a much more behind the scenes type role than what I did at Marvel.
Let me interject though. I mean, I think the editors are part of the creative team themselves, and it's simply because
at Marvel. I'm sorry. Maybe I misspoke. Yeah, at Marvel, I definitely felt a part of the creative process and, you know, upfront and doing stuff. And but at WWE, it was different because I wasn't on the creative. I wasn't on the creative team writing stuff for shows. I may have misspoke. I meant at WWE. I wasn't really part of the creative team.
Oh, okay.
And so, it was sort of a very different experience. You know, I was a wrestling fan before I started at WWE, but the more I worked at the WWE, I became more of a wrestling fan just because I was exposed to it so much. And being exposed to it made me want to seek out more and other. And so while I was working at WWE that I really started, like I had been to a Ring of Honor show or two beforehand, but it was while I was working at WWE that I really started branching out and following other sort of smaller promotions and things like that as well. And so I think just being immersed in that particular genre of entertainment sort of all day, every day was a real treat and was sort of a really neat part about the job.
Yeah, man, you seem to have you've kind of been living the type of life I would have liked to have lived for some time, really, with those gigs.
I've been real fortunate.
Yeah, it is.
I've been real fortunate getting the dream jobs faces.
Yeah, man. Even though you didn't really get to be part of the creative aspect of the WWE stuff, at least you got to be there. You were involved in some way, and you got to encounter some of the people that make the whole thing happen.
Yeah, of course. And it was neat too, because we'd get the scripts. We'd get the scripts before the show started. So we could sort of write ahead and know where things were going and stuff like that. And that was, I remember the first time I got my hands on a script for Raw, I thought it was the coolest thing, just seeing what was planned out and what wasn't. And, you know, because not only, the scripts actually, you know, each segment, it says, you know, written by so-and-so, and it says whoever on the creative team wrote it. But each match also has the agent listed, right? The road agent, or they call them producers on the script. Yeah. But, you know, so you can look and say, oh, wow, this is a really great match. I wonder who worked with these guys on the match. Oh, it was Pat Patterson, right? Or, oh, it was Arn Anderson or whatever, which was, I found that to be fascinating. It was sort of a really neat look behind the curtain.
Yeah. Speaking, kind of going back a bit, how do pro wrestling scripts or Raw scripts for shows like Raw compare to, like, say, a comic script? Just out of curiosity.
What do you mean? Just in terms of like format,
Maybe in format, or just how detailed are they, or you know, just in general.
The wrestling scripts are generally pretty detailed. The promos and things like that, they're usually scripted out pretty tightly. You know, and which is impressive also because it means that those guys have to memorize that stuff before they go out, and it's not like, you know, a play where they've had weeks to work on the script. They didn't send out on finalized Raw scripts until a lot of times, like at the earliest, like 4:30 p.m. on a Monday, right? So it's only a few hours that these guys have to sort of memorize their lines. And it varies depending on the guy, because there were certain guys, like when I was there, like Jericho, right? Jericho, from my understanding, would work up a lot of his promos himself. And so that he would work with the writers and tell them basically what he was going to say, and they'd slot it into the script. Some of the younger guys, people who weren't as talented on the microphone, would be given things that they had to go out and say. And so while they might vary a little bit from the wording, or switch things around, or pause places, or toss something in to interact with the crowd, it was pretty tight. It was pretty close to what they had there. When it came to the actual matches, though, usually all that we got was a finish. Sometimes not even that. And sometimes it would be specific, and so-and-so runs in and there's a DQ. And sometimes it would just be, Big Show goes over or whatever. We didn't get any information on major spots or anything like that. And they sort of kept that under their hat. But format-wise, the wrestling scripts are sort of their own beast. More and more, if you look at comic book scripts, people are trying to write them like, for better or for worse, people are writing them like screenplays or teleplays,
mm-hmm.
which I sort of got my own thoughts on. But wrestling sort of remains its own, their scripts remain their own thing. It's from their own sort of distinct format that works for what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested to see what those scripts look like now. Just because it's such an interesting, it's a hybrid of all kinds of stuff from what I'm hearing. The different segments, just the fact that they tell you how the match would go. Well, not specifically, right? But how it ends. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, and if you go online, you can find some, because they'll leak every once in a while. Every once in a while, one of them will leak to the internet, and just for a random Raw or pay-per-view or something mm-hmm. like that, especially after the fact. You can find them online. They're neat. They're definitely worth looking at.
Mm-hmm. I'll be checking that stuff out. Now kind of getting into writing a bit. You've been doing freelance writing right now, for sites like Yugo and a few others. How did that come about? Was it something you've always wanted to do, or it was just something that came about since you kind of have gotten enough experience, working with writers?
My long-term goal with comics, ever since I started interning, was I wanted to write comic books. Mm-hmm. And that's why I got the internship and why I started working at Marvel, is because mm-hmm. I wanted the experience. I wanted to learn more, because I figured, how better to learn mm-hmm. about how comic book gets put together than to be an editor, right, mm-hmm. and see all of it, and see all of it come together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always been my long-term goal. And, Marvel's got their very strict, unlike DC, which is sort of more open to editors writing for them. Marvel's very strict about, if you work for the company, you're not allowed to write for the company. And that's because they had a long period where half their line was written by editors, right? But they've got a pretty strict rule about it, and they've since made a pretty strict rule about former editors writing for them. So they're pretty hard-nosed about that. But, so that's always been the goal, and that's what I'm working on now. I mean, a lot of my efforts and energy right now are put into sort of trying to get some creator-owned things going and work on a web comic, which hopefully will be coming to fruition in the next few weeks.
Awesome.
And I've had a little bit of success here and there writing for different places. I did a Superboy story in DC's Superman 80-page Giant that came out in February, and Kirkman and I wrote some Tech Jacket backups that ran in issues of Invincible. I think the last one was in 81,
mm-hmm.
Which is a couple months ago. And a couple other things here and there. But it's, as you and everybody else knows, it's tough right now getting creator-owned stuff off the ground just because the industry is sort of in such dire straits. But, so that's always been the goal. But after I left WWE, I did want to sort of start branching out and writing. I miss writing about wrestling, because I love writing about wrestling, and I feel like I didn't get to write enough about wrestling, especially sort of critical analysis type stuff about wrestling, like mm-hmm. intelligent writing about wrestling. I didn't get to do enough of that at Marvel, so I was really fortunate to sort of fall in with the Yu-Gi-Oh guys mm-hmm. and start doing weekly wrestling content for them. And from there, they liked my writing enough that I started doing sort of other pop culture and movie news things for them, which led to right now I do a lot of movie news for IFC. .com and also some for MTV.com as well, and sort of some television writing for another few websites and places.
That's cool, man. I mean, it's always been fun to kind of get into the whole pop culture beat of things. I mean, I've always kind of wanted to branch in that direction as well, the podcast and was it's supposed to be with a blog also, and I haven't been able to work on the blog much lately because I've just been busy with other stuff with comics related stuff that I'm doing. So I've always envied people who do all the writing and doing reviews and that sort of thing. Now you kind of since we're kind of in it right now, you mentioned that the comics industry is in your opinion, is kind of in dark space. I want to see what your thoughts are on the industry as it stands right now, especially with regards to all that's going on with the DC doing their big relaunch, and of course just whatever Marvel's up to as far as their books are.
Mm-hmm. It's no big secret to begin. I mean, it's no big secret that sort of everywhere, every industry is struggling economically, mm-hmm. And even more so than that, publishing, right? Because publishing has sort of been on a slow decline for years now, and then even a subsection of that, comics is struggling even more, right? It sounds like it really doom and gloom about it. But I don't think there's a call for it. I don't think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. Because comics has been through rough patches before.
Yeah.
And it always bounces back. And all it takes to bounce back, honestly, is one comic book, one graphic novel, one story, one web comic that resonates with a large audience. That's all it takes. You know what I'm saying? Like, all it takes is for something to be good enough. And there's still, especially now that with sort of the diffusion of pop culture and the way people find things online, if something's really good, people are going to start talking about it, and it'll find an audience. And, we're never going to get back to, comics is never going to become a mass appeal? It's not going to be appreciated. Yeah, it's not going to be a mass appeal medium. You know, comics isn't all of a sudden going to turn into television or movies, right? And it shouldn't, frankly. And I think that's sort of it doesn't make sense to try for that, right? Because the people who like comics for real specific reasons, and they aren't the same reasons that people like television and movies, In order to stay vital and relevant as a medium, comics have had to narrow their focus, right? And whether that means sort of experimentalist and formalist art comics and indie comics and things like that, or it means the development and curating of this gigantic universe. Either one of those are very specific niche appeal things that comics can do and do really well. So I think that the industry's changing, but I'm not worried about it, especially with digital being right around the corner. And the only thing that upsets me is I wish that not just the big companies, because DC started to, and Marvel's sort of having everything available day and date, and Marvel's starting to, slowly with Spider-Man stuff and the Ultimate stuff and the X-Men stuff coming up. But I wish other publishers would too, because as much as people love the direct market, it's a middleman, right? Like Diamond, because in between the publishers and the consumer, you've got shippers, you've got Diamond warehouses, you've got the direct market, and it's a lot of middlemen. And it's not just comics that are moving away from having middlemen. And I'm not the type of person who will rejoice in anybody losing their job, but at the same time, it's an evolution of the industry. And I wish people were sort of a little bit quicker to embrace digital. And I think that, because I think that DC, I'm hoping that DC is finding that they're reaching out to a lot of new customers. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there about people coming back into the fold through DC's sort of day-and-date digital delivery program. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about it. I'm not sure whether there'll ever be any sort of concrete statistics or numbers. But they could start doing that earlier, right?
I think
that could have started earlier than it did, and I wish it had. I don't know. Comic books move in. Everything moves in cycles, And everywhere, it's not just comics that are struggling right now. Everybody's struggling. So I don't know. I'm pretty optimistic.
Yeah, same here. You mentioned the middleman in business in the comics business, and the thing is, I have a friend who he encountered the DC commercials on TV, which is great because he has not read a comic book in years. And he went to a local comic store, and only to find out that the comic store basically just ordered enough copies of all the new books for its subscribers who asked them to. And which is a damn shame, and this is really short-sighted because, you want to grow your business, And here you are ordering just enough for the people who want the books, and then later on you're probably going to bitch about how, you know, this new thing never did anything for me. And now my friend ended up going digital instead.
But it's not even – I mean, you can't even point the finger at the comic book retailers too much because they have to buy all that stuff non-returnable. So I don't blame them. You know, and like most comic book shops – like you're in San Diego, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, San, you know, and I'm in New York. And so we've got a real skewed perspective because we've got these big, beautiful, nice, well-stocked, bright comic book stores. And they're doing all right for themselves, right? They're in high-traffic areas. They're in sort of very pop culture literate cities, right? Mm-hmm. And most of the comic book stores in the country aren't. You know, they're in dark little holes shoved away in strip mall places that are barely making ends meet. And the way they make ends meet is ordering exactly what they know they're going to sell. Because the back issues market doesn't make anybody any money anymore, right? You know, extra issues of, even if it's, you know, and maybe number ones are different, but, you know, extra issues of random Marvel or DC comic that they have now, those aren't going to sell for more money in a year or two, especially because they'll be collected already. So you can't really blame these guys for ordering only what they know they can sell. You know, the thing that frustrates me the most is, you know, you can't talk about day-to-day delivery and especially, you know, for me, a big issue is the pricing of it also. You know, like, I think it's great that DC is offering all of DC and Marvel, though, they're offering all the comics available digitally on the day that they come out in stores. But I wish it was just a little bit cheaper. Even, you know, 50 cents or a dollar would be great. Not because it's not worth it, because it is. And honestly, for me, and I'm buying them all that way now because I just don't have room in my apartment. I don't have space to keep buying comic books. And I'd much rather have them visually, and it's an ease of access issue, you know, so I don't have to dig through a long box and pull them out of the bags and boards. I can just pull it up on my device. But you can't talk about that stuff without somebody popping up and saying, oh, what about the retailers? You're going to put the retailers out of business. You know, you can't have them – you can't have comic books available day and day because it's going to put the retailers out of business. And if you're going to do it, you have to only have them available at 2 p.m. You can't have them – you know, yeah, that's what it works out, which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
Because now the argument too is, oh, well, you can't do them cheaper than the $2.99 or $3.99 price point, whatever it may be. You can't do them cheaper than that because then you're going to put the direct market out of business. And I think that's false because I think that the people who go to the direct market stores, who go to their local comic book shop every week, those are dyed-in-the-wool, diehard fans, right?
Exactly.
And they want a physical prop, a physical copy, and a physical product, right, for the most part. And sure, some people might stop going, and that's to be expected. But for the most part, I think those people want, you know, that fetish item that, you know, to put in a box, and because that's part of the appeal for them is collecting these things. Who you're missing out on by not having things available day and date, and this is for all companies, not just Marvel and DC, and who you're missing out on by not making it a little bit cheaper are the untold thousands of people out there who are downloading torrents, who are pirating stuff. And I'm not defending people who download pirated material because it's immoral and it's illegal and you shouldn't be doing it. But you understand why people are doing it when you realize that, you know, these people don't want a physical copy. They don't want to have to go into a direct market comic book store. And they don't, you know, they want a digital copy anyways. And so they're going to find a way to get it, right, whether you make it available to them or not.
Yeah, and if you don't make it a little bit, exactly.
And it's, and the worst thing about it, too, another thing about it, too, is that I think that there's a weird a mental block. Like, for me personally, I know, like, I look at a comic book and I say, oh, it's $3.99 to buy a digital version of it. I can get the print one for that. I should just go buy the print one. Even though I don't even want the print one, I feel like I should because I feel like I'm getting more out of it. So I'll have like an actual physical object to hold in my hand, mm-hmm. right? And I think that that's a tough thing for a lot of people to get around. And, you know, if you look at iTunes, the success of iTunes as an example, iTunes didn't just succeed because it had everything and you could download it immediately. It succeeded because it was cheaper. You know, when iTunes busted out and said you can buy an album for $10, you can buy any album for $10, CDs cost like 17 or 18 bucks at that point. CDs had gotten really expensive, and that was a big part of the appeal to people, and it was how people got around this obsession with having a physical item. I started ranting. I'm sorry. I think it upsets me that Marvel and DC haven't been. I understand how sort of slavish they've been to the direct market because it's a market that served them so well for so long and so loyally. But at the same time, I think that they're looking at, they can't do both. They can't continue to serve only direct market and grow their business and keep their business healthy. And at a certain point, you have to say, yeah, and you guys, you direct market buyers, you might not be happy about us offering things day and date for cheaper than what you're selling them in the stores, but tough.
It all boils down to, it's a business, and you got to expand where you can, and you have to take advantage of every possible avenue that you could take to increase revenue and do what you need to do. And I think it's nice that they're slowly catching on. And I think Marvel, what titles haven't they announced that will go day and date, just the Avengers stuff at this point? The X-Men, Spider-Man, the Ultimate stuff, they're all going to be day and date. And it's just their biggest franchise right now, which is about to be, the big movie for next year. That's the only thing that they need to get that out there and get that day and date and get people in on that thing on the ground floor, because it could be a missed opportunity for them if they don't do it.
Yep. And I just wish it was a little bit cheaper. I just wish it was a little bit cheaper, because I think they'd be able to lure a lot of people away from torrents and pirated material. It's just a little bit cheaper.
Even if they follow what DC is doing, where they're doing it goes down a dollar after a month, even that would be a good idea.
I don't know how much of a difference that'll make. I think that's kind of a nice gesture, but I don't know if it's going to accomplish anything, because the nature of these things is they're periodicals, and you want them now. You want them when they come out. I don't want to buy Action Comics next month. I want to buy it the week that everybody's online talking about it.
That's
right?
True also.
And so, if you really want it, you're going to go download it. And people act like pirates, are just like comic pirates are, they're just, these dyed-in-the-wool villains, and they're, they've got pirate everything. They pirate everything, and they're never going to buy anything, and that's just the way it is. You can't do anything about it. And I don't think that's true. I think that, and it's the same thing with music, right? Another reason everybody stopped using Napster and BitTorrents and things like that to download music files and started using iTunes instead was because it was reliable and it was in a format that was easy to use. And you can make the same argument about, like Comixology versus downloading a CBZ file. Because if you download a CBZ file, it's just kind of a pain to use, right? It's not formatted right. They're all different sizes. It's not pleasant. But if you download you can pay $2 or $3, download the legal version of it, and it's super easy, and it goes right to your iPad or your iPhone or whatever, I think that the audience wants to be able to pay for things and get them legally, but you got to make it easy for them, right?
I don't think
anybody wants to wait a month to read a comic book, a new comic book.
That's true.
I think by that time they've either downloaded a pirate copy or they stopped giving a shit, right? Because think about all that happens in the course of a month. By the time the first issue of Action Comics is available for a dollar less, the second one will be out there. There are other things to buy,
Yeah, it can be kind of counterproductive to do it that way, but I've always been curious as to I don't know if you're aware of any of how the inner workings of this particular aspect of the industry is, but I've always been curious to what aside from protecting the so-called direct market, what really drives them into keeping that price point. I don't see why, they could be going for. I mean, to be honest with you, I think the perfect price point for a book like this would be probably half of what they're charging right now, like maybe $1.50 for a book. And I don't
really?
I mean, I don't know. Heck, 99 cents would be good for me, in my opinion.
Are you talking about digital version or print version?
Yeah, just the digital versions.
So what's your question?
Aside from protecting the direct market, do you think there's any other reasons to why they're maintaining their price point the way they are?
I mean,
I'm assuming there are fees with Apple.
It is more complex than that.
Yeah,
it is more complex than just protecting the direct market. I mean, one of the things is, one of the big things is that anything that they sell through these Comixology apps, Apple's got to take their cut.
Right? Yeah.
Apple's got to take a cut, and I forget what it is, but it's sizable, right? Any kind of in-app purchases, Apple takes a sizable cut from that. And not only is Apple taking a cut, but Comixology is taking a cut.
Of course, yeah.
Right? So you're not without costs. You know what I'm saying? When people say, I don't understand, these things could be practically free because you're not printing it, you're not shipping anything, you know, there's a direct market taking a cut. That's not exactly true because there are costs involved. And, you know, this stuff has to be formatted and there's time involved and there are costs. So that's one. I think another reason why they're most, and this is sort of conjecture and speculation on my part, but I think another reason why they're sort of reluctant to come out of the gate with a lower price point is that you can always lower prices and people will cheer you in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
But if you raise them, there are going to be outcries. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they were to start these initiatives from saying, the books are $1.99 or $1.50 or whatever, and then it turned out that that's not exactly profitable because they're not moving the amount of units that they expected to be, mm-hmm. and then they have to raise things to $2.50 or $2.99, mm-hmm. then people would be furious, and we'd have people on internet message boards just freaking the fuck out, right?
They will do it anyway.
Whereas now, exactly. Whereas now you can open at a slightly higher price, and if things go well. And, you know, which hopefully they do, maybe they'll look at the books and be able to say, you know, we can actually start selling these for less, which they probably won't, but it's an option, right?
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, is it's just sort of standard run-of-the-mill business in that why sell something for $150 when you can sell it for $2.99, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that Marvel sort of realized with or tried to sort of pull off with their sort of line-wide price increases, which was that, you know, they did market research and they decided that, yeah, they can actually make more money by selling these comic books at a higher price point. And maybe they'll even sell – I can't remember if this was just some like a rumor thing or if it was actually something legit, but I remember reading somewhere that they had sort of – the company had sort of decided that even if they sell less copies of Avengers, the higher price point is going to compensate for that and they're going to end up making more money. Right.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of reasons. I mean, aside from the direct market thing of why they don't do, why they don't have them at a lower price point. But I'm talking more about whenever you see somebody online talking about day and date or digital comics or anything like that, I feel like I don't know. Maybe they're retailers themselves, or maybe they're just people who are just feel like the need to defend the retailers. There are like people popping in on message boards or on Twitter saying, "What do you want? You just want the direct market to disappear? You're going to put the direct market out of business?" All this stuff is like, "Wow!" And I think they're all things. I think they're wrong, but yeah.
Yeah. what I find funny, though, is that whenever Marvel or DC would do sales on Comixology for 99 cents, I see a lot of chatter going on Twitter, people buying, like, ridiculous amounts of books for 99 cents digitally because, hey, it's 99 cents. Maybe they should pay more attention to whenever they do that because it might mean something for them later on because I guess a lot of people are – there's a lot of people who really don't mind buying digital. It's just about – it's all about the price point for them. And if they go lower and they decide to do that, I don't know. It could turn into that big, digital boom for either company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, two things. Like something similar that I wish they did more of was a while ago that you could buy all of Planetary for like 28 or 29 bucks or something like that.
Yeah, they did a digital omnibus.
Yeah, exactly. You could buy the whole thing, and it was $28. And I wish they'd do more of that. You know, I wish that they'd, sell trades at discounts on Comixology, and I wish they'd start doing subscriptions too. You know, like if I decide I want to buy 12 issues of Action Comics, I could buy a subscription to that at a discount. And I don't know. Hopefully, they will start doing that.
I think the companies have been experimenting on that, like. A few months ago, Marvel put out a $5, basically a trade of this the X-Men Spider-Man miniseries that Christos Gage did,
mm-hmm.
and they were marketing that for $5. And I was like, wow, that's I don't know if they were just testing the waters or something, but I thought that was a good deal. Those issues were like $4 each when they were coming out, So you get, getting the whole thing for $5 is it's awesome, and it's still $5 right now if you look it up. They really need to do more of that.
Both companies have really neat opportunities right now to do fun stuff like that and to build sort of pseudo trades out of their back catalog, you know. And it's stuff that kind of thing is going to be almost pure profit because they've already made their money on those books, right? Like in the way the businesses work and the way things get written off, like. Mm-hmm. That Christos Gage miniseries, that's already paid for, right? Yeah. It's already paid for itself. And so anything they make now is just gravy.
Exactly.
And they've got literally decades worth of material that they can do that with. You know, I was really delighted last night because I was sitting around and I was thinking, you know what, I'd really like to read Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, right? Uh-huh. And so I went on Comixology and it was there. It was on the DC app or whatever, and so I could download it. And that's a great thing. And I wish they'd sort of do more of that kind of thing. And hopefully they will. Hopefully they'll start to. I mean, but something you mentioned was, you know, the way chatter on Twitter and things like that, and they do 99-cent sales. And I think it's a really tough thing for a lot of businesses to navigate right now, not just Marvel and DC, which is how much that's actually worth. You know what I'm saying? Because, like, to you and I, you know, we look at our Twitter feed and everybody's freaking out about, to look at you and I's Twitter feed, probably, I'm guessing for you, you would think that Animal Man, the comic book, sold 500,000 copies, right?
Yes.
That's what I would think from my Twitter feed, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not true, and because it's these self-selecting, non-representational samples. And even when I was at Marvel, it was always a struggle trying to figure out what kind of internet chatter you paid attention to and what kind you discounted. You know, another great example was, you mentioned earlier, Ant-Man. Mm-hmm. People on the internet loved Ant-Man, and Ant-Man had some of those vocal fans, but that book didn't sell for beans. It didn't sell well at all. Nobody bought it, but people loved talking about it. So it's, I don't know. It's a tough thing, and it's not as easy as just saying, like, people on the internet talk a lot about, you know, people on Twitter talk a lot about this. They, you know, they should do more of that, and they should capitalize on it, because I'm not sure how much it's actually worth, you know?
Yeah, and kind of go around. I mean, that sort of thing also affects, like, you know, the wrestling stuff that we're into right now. I mean, everyone's talking about the punk thing that's been going on for the last few weeks.
The views and opinions expressed by the guests and those providing comments are theirs alone and do not necessarily reflect the views of Pat Loika. You can reach Pat by sending an email to loikamania@gmail.com. This has been a Dial R Studios production.
But then you hear about the pay-per-view buys for the last, you know, couple months, like, you know, Money in the Bank and then SummerSlam. It's really not that great. And
with wrestling it's even more complicated because you know, it's wrestling, a lot of wrestling is based on, you know, because if you were asking what the biggest problem with WWE is, and by extension TNA as well, because they run their business very similarly, is that they still run their business as if it's a live event company that also tapes the appearances, right? But then they should be running their shows and their businesses as if it's a television show, right? And so a lot of the decisions at WWE, I'm guessing TNA too, but a lot of decisions at WWE get made based on the reception that wrestlers get in the ring and at the arenas, right? But that's not a very good to get back to the self-selecting sample thing, people who shell out money to go to shows, places, that's not a representational sample. Those are your Uber fans, right? Those are the people who have the disposable income and are willing to spend it to go to these shows, right? So especially if you have shows at places like L.A. or, you know, I was at SummerSlam this last year, right? And you would think, from listening to the crowd, you would have thought that John Cena was the biggest heel in the business. But he's not. You know, people love that guy. And, you know, it seemed like every other person in the crowd had, like, one of those white CM Punk T-shirts on. But that's because it's L.A. That's because it's L.A. and it's the people who shelled out however many bucks to go to SummerSlam, you know? So I think you're absolutely right. And WWE did sort of a really excellent job of playing both sides against each other, right? Playing the smarky internet fans like us against sort of the more naive, which is the more innocent and honest sort of traditional wrestling fans, right? And yeah, it's been a struggle for them to keep that up.
Yeah, and they really don't know what their audience is anymore, and you can kind of tell just based on some of the booking they're doing. I don't even know what to think of what they're doing anymore, and you know they change their minds so often. I don't think they do any real long term planning anymore, and it's really sad. And they had something really good, and they kind of botched it in the end.
Yeah, they do some long-term planning, and you know, and the defense is always, well, you know, people get hurt, things change, a guy gets a different reaction, so we want to be able to change on the fly, right? And that's fine. It's fine to change things on the fly, but I mean, I think a perfect example is the fucking Kevin Nash of Techwear. Is that okay?
No, go ahead.
Okay, the fucking Kevin Nash thing. Honestly, like, I was at that SummerSlam, right, in LA, and he came out, and everybody in the audience, including myself, freaked out because, oh my God, it's been sexy. What's he doing here? And he powerbombed the bejesus out of CM Punk, and it looked great, and it was a neat moment, except for the fact that it didn't make a lick of sense, right? It was a huge shock, and it was a huge surprise because it came completely out of left field, right?
Uh-huh.
It's like a murder mystery that ends with the murderer being revealed to be a guy that hasn't been involved in the story. Right? It doesn't make any sense. And it's not a satisfying conclusion. And I remember reading on Twitter, people were shitting on it and saying, fucking Kevin Nash and all that stuff, including myself. And I read other people saying, you shouldn't judge until you see where it's going. And you shouldn't judge until you see where it's going. But I didn't think that was fair. I think it is fair to judge because that was a big moment. And it was meant to be a big moment. And it was at SummerSlam, which is the second biggest pay-per-view of the year. And they paid it off with a surprise that didn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
And then come to find out, it didn't go anywhere. It went absolutely nowhere, right?
Yeah.
The big reveal was that, he was there because somebody sent a text message, and the person who sent a text message was himself from Triple H himself. Like, can you think of anything more convoluted? It's ridiculous. What makes it even worse is that, they were building up. They were clearly building up for a big, first of all, they were ignoring the obvious conflict between CM Punk and Triple H, right? And so they decided to put down the back burner for whatever reason and instead pursue this match that no one gave a shit about. Nobody wanted to see CM Punk versus Kevin Nash, right? They'd rather see CM Punk versus anybody else aside from this big old idiot. And instead they pushed that. And they planned so little. And they had so little foresight that that guy wasn't even, according to dirt sheets, that guy's not even cleared to wrestle. That guy couldn't even wrestle.
Yeah, no.
It's assuming the dirt sheets are right, but they were building a program that was supposed to end with a big match against this guy, but he's not even cleared to wrestle, so he can't wrestle. And so now they do nothing with it, and it's completely dead, and they've just murdered CM Punk's heat.
Oh, yeah.
Through the way they botched his program. It's really upsetting. And he's still great, and he still does great promos and stuff, but they lost every bit of momentum they were gaining. I remember, in the heat of all that CM Punk stuff, telling people who don't watch wrestling, just telling them, listen, if you've ever thought about watching wrestling now, right now, start right now, because it was awesome, and they completely screwed the pooch on it. It's really upsetting.
Yeah, man. I mean, when I remember watching SummerSlam, I was watching on pay-per-view with a bunch of friends, and we were just like, what the hell? Is that Kevin Nash? Because first of all, the cameraman kind of messed up, and you kind of saw him coming. And from our angle, they're showing, they had the hard camera, and it was kind of a big shot. And you kind of see him coming from the back. I'm like, hey, who is that big dude who's moving, making his way up front? Then I realized it's Kevin Nash, and then I was thinking, man, he better not pull his quad again.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure shocked he's been on TV this many times and no one made a joke about him pulling his quad.
I've been making a lot of those stupid jokes over the last few weeks just because Kevin Nash kind of annoys me. And man, that guy is so out of it because he couldn't cut a decent promo to save his life over the time he came back. It's really sad. And
I was really disappointed. I feel like he was doing better work. I feel like he was doing better mic work even in TNA the past couple of years. I remember a year or two ago seeing him in TNA and thinking, hey, look at that guy. Still cutting a good promo, but The stuff with Punk is not good.
Yeah, man, I feel really bad for Punk because Punk was really on the rise, and he's built himself up to a point too where it's kind of foolproof now, and it's just unfortunate that they wasted all those weeks building him up with Nash when they could have been building Triple H up, or that he could have just gone for a rematch, or he could have just gotten his rematch with Del Rio, because that
I wish they had kept the belt on him. Honestly, I wish they had kept the belt on him because I felt that would have really helped propel him to the next level.
They should have kept it on him.
What's frustrating about it too is his new gimmick is this idea of I want to change the WWE and I'm campaigning for change, and it's just I get what it's supposed to do, and I get how it's supposed to appeal to sort of internet fans like ourselves, like who read the dirt sheets and all stuff and things like that. But it's just so vague. It's so vague, and it feels so insincere. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel real in the same way his other promos did. And I think it's because it's something that WWE's had a real problem with recently, like the past 5 years or so, which is that, and I don't know exactly why. I don't know if it's just something about society has changed or, moved away from the edge era or what, but whenever guys turn face, mm-hmm. they also get defanged. Right?
Yeah.
Another perfect example is John Morrison, who was awesome as a heel. And he's still great in the ring. He's still great to watch wrestle. But that guy as a heel was great because he's a dick. And he's mean, and he made fun of people. And him and Miz together were hilarious. And as soon as they turned him face, right, and Miz turned heel on him and stuff, he lost everything about him that made him cool. Everything that made me want to like that guy just went out the window. And some of the same things happened with Punk, because the reason everybody responded to Punk the way they did was because he was being kind of a dick, right? He was mean.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He was saying the stuff that everybody was thinking, nobody else wanted to say, and he was a pipe bomb and all that stuff. But what it was that everybody wanted to say was how dick it was, how mean he was about things. And now, I want change, and I want change to come to WWE. It doesn't have quite the same venom and weight that his earlier promos did. It's like disappointing. I don't know. I still love that guy. He's my favorite guy working right now, and I think he's the best. But I just sort of wish.
I think that he's
angle had gone a different direction.
Yeah, there are so many potential. There's a lot of potential in the angle, which, and it's sad that because some of the scenarios and some of the things that people have been thinking about turn out better than the actual angle itself as it did. I mean, they could have done this thing with that whole text message thing. They could have done something where it was Stephanie who had sent it.
That's what everybody was saying.
Yeah, Stephanie or even Laurinaitis, John Laurinaitis, which would have made sense too.
You can always play sort of backseat driver with this stuff, and I do it too. Because the thing that killed me about the Nash thing, for instance, is something similar, which is that how many people could they have had run out that would have made more sense, right? Any of the guys that CM Punk had mentioned, mm-hmm. right? Colt Cabana, mm-hmm. Luke Gallows, hire those guys back. And guess what? Now the storyline is that Triple H offered them a job if they'd come in and beat up CM Punk, right? Uh-huh. And now they're back in a company that they're working for. That's great drama. That's insane. It was elsewhere. Anybody on the roster would have made more sense than just a random guy from decades ago, uh-huh. But at the same time, and this is another thing too. It's WWE's idea, I think this comes down to the way they position themselves as a live event company first and a TV product second, which is that to them the most important thing is always to surprise people. It's always to shock people, and because that's what gets you a good reaction in the audience. Because people freaked out in the Staples Center when Kevin Nash came out, right? And mm-hmm. only a few moments afterward, everybody said, oh, wait a minute. What does this mean? Where is this going? This isn't a satisfying ending to this event,
Yeah.
We're only after that. And so, for them, it's, things like what you just said with Stephanie, that would have made perfect story sense, right? Because CM Punk pissed her off and made fun of her and told these nasty things about her and to her, and that would have made perfect sense if she used her husband's cell phone to message one of his old pals, right?
Yeah.
But I think WWE worries that oh, well, fans are going to guess it. Fans are going to guess that's what's going to happen, and they're going to learn. Then they're going to start thinking that the product is stale and predictable, and they're going to stop watching. So I think that they sort of place a really huge amount of importance on the shock value and shocking people and startling people and doing stuff that they didn't expect it. And then, you know, if it doesn't make sense, oh, we'll figure it out later. We'll write some weird storyline where Kevin Nash sent himself the message, right? And
oh, man. God, there's just so much. It's so illogical, the whole Nash thing.
Yeah,
it really bugged me. I have one of my co-hosts here. His name's Antonio, and he has been very, very angry over the whole thing. And he has some epic rants over the whole Kevin Nash thing. And it was just, they should never have even done that. I know they had him signed for some kind of contract for some time now, but they didn't need to do that. But I mean, as far as what's going on right now, I mean, in both comics and wrestling, what are you currently into? I mean, that you're really digging. And before we close out,
just stuff I like.
Yeah, what stuff are you digging right now? You got anything you want to recommend to people to check out in either?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Comics wise, I mentioned it earlier. Animal Man. Awesome. Animal Man, really, really great. The new one by Jeff Lemire and Travel Foreman. Mm-hmm. I started off reading it, and like the first few pages, I was kind of disappointed because I was it's just a retread of the Morrison stuff. But by the end of the issue, it's turned into something completely different, and I thought that it benefited from sort of, there wasn't a bait and switch, but it was like a psych out because I thought we were just going to get more of sort of what we saw with that great Morrison run from years ago. Mm-hmm. But it's really evolved into something different. It played off that in a really fascinating way. That's really great. Action Comics, I mentioned earlier. I'm loving a lot of the, all of the New 52 stuff I've read, I've been absolutely nuts so far. I think it's fucking great.
Yeah, there's a lot of those books that I'm really, really into right now. And and some of the stuff that I really liked are the stuff that really surprised me. Like, I knew I was going to like Animal Man because I like Lemire. I like the character. So I knew I was getting into that. But man, I love Swamp Thing. I love Action.
Swamp Thing is neat.
Yeah, I loved O-Mac. Yeah,
I didn't read O-Mac. I have to check that one out. Yeah, I didn't read all of them. But the ones I read, I really dug. I actually just finished reading last night. I got off of eBay the two old Fantagraphics collections of Cheech Wizard. Stuff of like the Von Bode stuff or Bode. I don't know how you say it properly. But that stuff's really interesting, and it's very different type of comics, you know, because it's strip comics as opposed to sort of comic book type stuff. But it's really fascinating, and there's a lot of, he's a really influential guy. I grew up being a really big fan of Burke Breathed and Blue County and Opus and Outland and stuff like that. And I've always known that Breathed owed a huge debt to Gary Trudeau, or the Doonesbury guy. I'm really lousy at names. Gary Trudeau. He's really great debt to him, but massive, massive debt that I didn't realize that guy owes to Von Bode, just in terms of the way he draws his characters and their expressions and sort of the comedic beats of things and the timing. Was really interesting. Wrestling-wise, CM Punk obviously is one of the best in the business. I'm a big Dolph Ziggler fan. I think that guy's really great.
He's funny.
He's really good, man. And I think that that guy could be a real breakout talent for them. And I've liked that guy since he debuted. And he did something that it seems really simple, but I imagine it's pretty tough to actually do in the ring. But he talks. He talks a lot in the ring. And he screams and he yells. Mm-hmm. He's antagonistic while wrestling, you know, and you feel like a sense of anger and rage and menace from him that you don't from a lot of the other guys. And I think he's really great. And I like that he can wrestle amateur style, and, you know, he can do a suplex and he can do holds and stuff. I think he's really great talent. I think he's good on the mic too. And I love Vicky. I think Vicky is sort of one of, She's a real important part of WWE, man. She's incredible. She's so good. But I don't know why they've put her with him, because I don't think he needs her. I think that guy's sort of great on the mic. So I love Dolph Ziggler a lot. Outside of WWE, I really, it's sort of like a common, geeky internet Mark Lament, but I wish TNA would do more Samoa Joe, because that guy's rad.
Man, they really butchered him over the last year. I mean, the tournament
I think it's crazy. I think it's crazy that people who run wrestling companies are of the opinion that a losing streak angle ever
gets over.
In the history of wrestling, that has never gotten anybody over, a losing streak angle.
That's so stupid.
And so I wish they did something with him. Indie wrestling wise, I'm really excited about, have you heard about Wrestling Revolution?
Yes, I actually donated to that. I'm going to hit up one of the tapings.
I'm really excited about it. I get more excited every time they announce names, because especially the two guys in particular who I'm really big fans of, who are indie guys. I called them out on my list of either wrestlers to look out for, or building the best wrestling promotion or something like that. A list I did. Kenny Omega.
Yeah, dude, he's awesome.
Wrestling in Japan. Uh-huh. And yeah, and I've seen him wrestle with ROH before, and he's really great because he does he's really good and crisp and sharp in the ring. But the fun thing about him is that guy has like an otaku gimmick. He has like a nerdy
he does the Hadouken fireball from Street Fighter.
Yeah, but he does like a Tony Jaa knee to the chest move on people too. So I think that guy's great. And the other guy that I'm really excited that he's involved with that. I mean, because they got a lot of great guys in there, and Colt Cabana and Luke Gallows and MVP, and that stuff's all great. But I'm really excited for Sami Callihan. Have you seen that guy before?
I've never heard of him. The name's familiar, but I've never seen him.
He wrestles in like Dragon's Gate and Evolve. I know. I think he's done some stuff like in CZW, maybe. I haven't seen any of those shows, but definitely Dragon's Gate and Evolve. And he's not a big guy. He's kind of a little guy, but he's like a crazy little Taz with hair. Like, he wears a singlet, and his nickname is like the American Horror, and he acts like a maniac, and he screams a lot, and he does a lot of suplexes and just stiff punches and kicks and stuff. He's great. He's really, really fun, and I think he sort of deserves a bigger stage, so I'm excited about that.
I'm looking forward to that, man. They have an amazing group of people involved in that thing, and then they got Lance Storm involved also as a producer. It should be great. I mean, I really like watching the wrestling stuff because I want to see the action in the ring. I want to see the performances, and I want to see the matches. And of course, the promos are good too. But I like the in ring stuff a lot more, honestly. So I'm really excited for that.
It's great because its mission statement is a lot of what we've been talking about today, which is that if somebody would just treat wrestling like a television show. How long would it be, right? And think about story arcs and character development and three-act structure and stuff like how much better would it be, right?
So
I'm excited about it. Very excited.
All right. Well, Aubrey, it was fun chatting with you. Where can people find you online?
Twitter. Twitter's the best place to find me. I don't have a website or anything, but my Twitter's easy. It's just my name. It's at Aubrey, AUBREY, Sitterson. SITTERSON.
Excellent. I'll be sure to link that over at the show notes. Once again, thanks for coming on. It was fun talking to you. Maybe next time we do this, we'll just really just get into it and not. Since we've kind of gotten all the introductory stuff out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Anytime you want to talk wrestling comics, let me know.
Yeah, man. We usually try to do like a wrestling roundtable thing every month in the show. We should have you on for one of those. I think it'd be fun to get
your
opinion and stuff. All right, dude. Well, it was good talking to you again, and you take it easy.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Bye.
The views and opinions expressed by the guests and those providing comments are theirs alone and do not necessarily reflect the views of Pat Loika. You can reach Pat by sending an email to loikamania@gmail.com. This has been a Dial R Studios production.